All right, tonight we're in the 8th chapter of Hebrews. Have I missed anything else? I sure hope not. We shouldn't, I hope tonight, be too long. Most of you are exhausted and weary over our missions conference last week, although it was such a blessed time. I can't think of a more wonderful time that I've ever enjoyed in the presence of the Lord than last week. Wednesday and Thursday night were certainly highlights, but every night there was a building sense of God's presence, and we rejoice in that. The 13 verses of Hebrews chapter 8 is a short section, but it's a dynamic section. In its larger relationship, we're talking about the 8th chapter, verse 1, through chapter 10, verse 18. I think maybe I should, because of the taping, keep this thing with me, all right? So that this is the larger section that we begin, and it is the concluding section of the teaching portion of the book. You remember that I told you one way, if you want to be a Bible scholar and impress people with what you know about Hebrews, just remember that up through chapter 10, we are learning about what Jesus is and all about him, excellent, more excellent and superior, and the key word is superior, to the angels and prophets and the old covenant and so forth and so on, the old priesthood. But then in the last three chapters, we are dealing with having therefore such a high priest, let us therefore. And so that the division becomes one of learning about Jesus, and you might say, all that we have going for us. The first chapters are really trying to explain to us all that we have going for us in Christ. Better covenant, better priesthood, mediator, more surety, all of these wonderful things. And then we will get to, following the teaching section, we will get to the exhortation section, which is now on the basis of this. Let your brotherly love continue and see that this is in your life and so forth. So we're still in the teaching section, and this is the last of the teaching section here, chapter 8, verses 1 through chapter 10 and verse 18. And this is the passage, the concluding passage, which deals with Christ in the heavenly sanctuary. And this is the passage that really the book of Hebrews is most known for. Because this is the passage that not only is most often quoted, but it's the passage which is a grand octave in the Holy Spirit from the Old Testament. And it is the passage that takes the tabernacle of the Old Testament and the priesthood of the Old Testament and the sacrifices of the Old Testament and reveals them as they are summed up in Christ. So there are three basic concepts that we deal with in these passages in this chapter 8, 1 through 10, 18. One is the concept of the atoning sacrifice, and we will be secondly, the priestly ministry, and thirdly, the actual concept that comes to us of the heavenly sanctuary. So these are three the three concepts we will be dealing with. And again, you can see these are all octaves of the actual study of the Old Testament. In fact, when I teach the tabernacle to our Omega College students, and incidentally, let me just say a word. I think there are a couple, perhaps, people who are interested in Omega from our body. And the Omega School begins next week. If God's speaking to you about a full-time commitment to learning the Bible and really doing it seriously, this is the way to do it. The Omega program is based on an 8 o'clock till 12 o'clock day, so our students, many of them work full time, and God has just provided us with a new dormitory facility in a miraculous set of circumstances in San Jose, and so this is a wonderful way to learn the scriptures in a very serious way, those of you who are able and who are really serious about scriptural study. But when we study the tabernacle, we use a three-book series by a man by the name of Slimmings, and I would recommend that book to you. I think I've talked to you about it before. C.L. Slimmings, S-L-E-M-M-I-N-G-S is the name. And it's what you call a trilogy. In other words, it's three paperback books. The first book is called Made According to the Pattern, and that's a book about the Old Testament sanctuary. It's a whole book on the sanctuary. The second book is called Thus Shall They Serve, and that's a book about the priestly ministry and how it foretells from the Old Testament about Jesus. And the third book is a book about the sacrifices, and I've forgotten the exact title of that book, but it's a whole book given to the sacrificial system. And you remember there were five basic sacrifices. There were many ramifications of them, but there were five basic sacrifices. So you see, when I say these are the three elements that we're dealing with in Hebrews, it's interesting because these are the three basic elements that we deal with in the Old. And of course, we're going to find out in this passage in chapter 8 that the Old is but a shadow. But it's still important that we see the concept of these three as they emerge. Now, I'd like you to look to the first two verses of Hebrews 8. And I'm going to take some time on these verses because each word becomes important for a very specific reason. And I think you'll see this as we move through it tonight in this study. First of all, let me read it for you, beginning in verse 8. Now, in the things which we are saying, the chief point is this. We have such a high priest who sat down on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. Now, I want you to look with me to these words a moment. I very rarely take this much time on a single verse, and we may be on this single verse in its ramifications all evening, because it sets the tone for this whole passage. First of all, notice, and you must notice this, I'm sure you noticed it as we went. Here is the writer saying, now the sum of the whole thing is this. The chief point is this. Now, not all writers and not all speakers are honest about that kind of thing. You know, some are like the minister's notes. I saw, in fact, this is not untrue. I was about a 12-year-old boy, and we had an evangelist in our pulpit, and he left his sermon notes on the pulpit one day. It happened to be, of course, I think I've already told you, our house was right in the church. We lived in the church. You just walked through the door into our living room from the platform of the church. And so I was out. I always had responsibilities. In fact, we were never able to afford a piano, so I could only take piano lessons in the summer because they wouldn't heat the church for me to practice during the winter, so you know anything about Pennsylvania winters. And so I used to go in the church and practice the piano and so forth. And going by, I saw these notes and I looked at them. And to my shock, here in the notes at one point it said, cry at this point. And later on it said, shout. You know. And as someone else said once, they saw a minister's notes and it said, logic at this point is weak. Shout loudly. Well, not all people are honest. But when the writer to the Hebrews says, look, everything I've been saying to you up to this point really can be summed up in this one thing, then you better take notice of what he's saying, because obviously it's pretty important. And what he says is, the whole point of this explanation to you Hebrews who are about ready to go back or to try to compromise the strength and faith of the Christian message, the whole point of this is that you know the priesthood of Jesus Christ and the superiority of his ministry on behalf of us in the heavens. So that he zeroes in on, this isn't that Bible teacher who's doing this, and this isn't someone who's looking at it at a later point. This is the writer to the Hebrews himself who says, we are now dealing with the chief sum of the entire message that I'm giving to you about Jesus Christ and about the truth and strength of the gospel. And that's a pretty important thing. One of the things, of course, that he brings us to in this passage, and I'll make just this one introductory comment about this first point, the sum, that the chief point is this. One of the dangers, and it certainly was a danger in the Roman world, is trying to make an eclectic hodgepodge of everything religious and putting it all together. There's a big name for this. It's called syncretism. And it's the most tragic tendency that I see today. And it was very true in the Roman world. You see, the Roman world's never destroyed any gods. When they conquered a land, they just adopted the gods of that land. And as a result, the whole Roman approach was that wherever they went, they just combined religions. And this concept of syncretism is something I see so present in the church world today. And this is what the Hebrews were trying to do. The Hebrews were trying to say, well, we're Jews, and we have the law, we'll keep the law, and we'll keep the synagogue, and we'll keep these practices, and we'll add on to these practices Christ and the message of the gospel and so forth and so on. And this is the tendency that we see today in so many circles. In fact, of course, the combination of Christians with astrology and with Scientology and with all of these kinds of Eastern thoughts and blending them together so that they all are mixed into one point, you see. And the message of the book of Hebrews to these Jews was, you cannot do that. You reject Christ when you try to mix in all of these other things with Christ. And so the writer to the Hebrews is saying, the chief point of all of the teachings that we've brought to you to this moment, the chief point of this is that you see the centrality and superiority and absolute singleness of Jesus Christ. Now, in the next line, he says, we have such a high priest. And that's a very interesting phrase. And I want to just pause on that a moment. We have such a high priest. It's an exclamatory word. Now I want you to go back with me to the verse that I was not able to finish in our last lecture, because this such a high priest is an exact octave of the words in chapter 7, verses 26 and 7. Here he says, for such a high priest became us, holy, guileless, undefiled, separated from sinners, made higher than heavens, who needeth not daily like those high priests to offer up sacrifices for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. For this he did once for all when he offered up himself. Now look at this description of him. First of all, I love this phrase in the 26th verse of the 7th chapter. Such a high priest as what? Such a high priest as became us. What a wonderfully impressive word that is. In other words, such a high priest that was suited to us. That's really what the word means in the Greek. A high priest who was perfectly matched, perfectly suited for us and for our needs. And then you see the description. The first word actually in the Greek, hosios, is loving. And it's from that beautiful concept of full loving kindness. Doesn't that suit us? Doesn't that become us? Secondly, he's noble, which means free from basement and especially malice. Generous, noble spirit toward us. Again, remember now the word suit doesn't mean, the word become us doesn't mean we're worthy of that. Please don't get that connotation. It means what we need, what's perfectly suited to our need, what perfectly becomes us. Loving kindness, noble, free from any base or malice. Thirdly, undefiled. And that's an interesting word, and I haven't time to trace it for you in the Greek, but it's the same word that Paul uses, or rather that Peter uses, when he talks about our inheritance being in heaven, undefiled. And it's the exact opposite of the word when we talk about, for example, the Canaan inheritance, what the Jews received. It was defiled. It was corrupted. It was compromised. It faded. It was like anything of this earth. It could be touched. It could be affected. It could be taken by conquest. It could be diseased. It could be problematic. But this high priest is totally undefiled. And again, how much that is for us. He is set apart from sinners, and this doesn't mean above us in the sense of being untouchable. It means he is set apart or has completed his activity when he was hemmed in by sinful men in his life. He is set apart or set above
that experience, his victory, in other words, he is completed. Each of those phrases, such a priest as this. Another thing that I think of when I think of such is to back up a little further when you're saying such a priest and say, well, how has he been described in the book as a whole? In other words, the phrase, we have such a priest, automatically. Especially when he has said, now the whole summation of what I've said is this, that we have such a priest. One thinks of the things we have learned about the priesthood of Jesus and about his ministry with us up to this point. First of all, we've learned that he is superior. He is a priest who has brought total revelation. That's what the first chapter was about. The prophet's message was only partial. The message under the law was a little bit here and a little bit there. And this teacher had a little bit and that teacher had a little bit. But when this one came, this priest has a total revelation of truth. It's not partial, it's not incomplete, it's not guessing, but it's a total revelation. And then, of course, we learned in the second chapter, such refers to the fact that all the creation is put under this Christ. Who he is in reference to all the created life. And then in chapter 3 and 4, he is a priest who mediates because he's been reconciled, or he has reconciled us to the Father, and he's touched with the feelings of our infirmities. In chapter 5, he's the perfect sympathizer with everything that touches us. In chapter 6, he is himself, in his own person, the great high priest. And chapter 7, the order of Melchizedek. Those are like little pictures that we've learned about him. We have such a priest, such a high priest. The next phrase says, he sat down on the right hand of the majesty. Now this is a very important theme. I've already told you several times, no priest ever, any time, under history, under any provision of the law, ever sat down. Because the priest was never finished. In fact, if people would say to me, what is the one picture of the priesthood in the book of Hebrews that's superior to any other? And, you know, I've just told you, look at the pictures. Superior because in him the revelation is complete. Superior because in him he totally sympathizes with us. And he's totally adequate. And he's a complete mediator. And he's perfect. And he's eternal. And he doesn't have to make sacrifices over and over again. What's the picture that's the most important for the book of Hebrews? No question in my mind. It's summed up in these two words, sat down. Because that's the phrase that makes the contrast more visible to us than anything else. A priest never sat down before. Why? Because his job was never finished. There was never an end to sacrifice. There was never a complete sacrifice. You made one trespass offering and you had to start with another. You made one burnt offering, and then you had to make another offering of some vow or thanksgiving. And the priest, there were no chairs in the tabernacle, my friend. If that picture alone is in your mind, it sums up everything else. The completion of Christ's ministry. Three times in this book it says, he sat down. He sat down. Why? He could sit down because there were no more sacrifices to be made. There was not another offering. There was not another need. There was not more blood to be spilt. There was not waiting until some panic Christian or some panic sinner runs to the gate of the tabernacle and says, oh, but what I've done today. And you have to run and get another lamb. You see, the picture is the most obvious in the book. One sacrifice, by in the end of the earth he hath appeared, and by one sacrifice he hath forever put away sin by the offering of himself. So this is a priest who sits down. The word is, it's finished. It's completed. No more blood. No more sacrifice. No more offering. No more offerer coming wondering whether his offering will be received or not. Never again. And I've told you the key thing about the tabernacle. When we studied the tabernacle, I said, if you have one picture in your mind from the tabernacle, you'll forever understand grace. And you'll forever understand salvation. If it's not in your mind, you never will. And that is that when the offerer came, the only thing examined was what? The offering. Not the offerer. The priest didn't look behind the ears of the offerer to see if his ears were clean. He didn't say, undress and let me see if you have any blemish on you. The only thing that was ever examined was the offering. It had to be blameless. It had to be pure. It could not have a spot or any kind of disease. And even a you know, we think animals with little spots are cute, you know, a little black, little white dog with a black spot over his eye or something. We think that's darling. Well, that kind of an animal would never be accepted. That'd be a perfect sacrifice because it represented Christ. When you understand that, if you just get that principle clear, then automatically you've got the octave coming into the New Testament. What's examined in the New Testament? What's examined in the priesthood of Jesus? The offerer? Never! The offering. And the offering is Jesus, and it's completed. He is both the priest and the offering, and he sits down. Where is he? On the right hand of the majesty in heaven. His place of exaltation. Now, I tell my students in the book of Acts, and we're studying Acts now at Bethany Bible College in one of my classes there, and I tell them that probably the least understood teaching and the most important teaching in the New Testament is the teaching of the ascension. In a sense, the ascension is more essential than the resurrection in one sense. It certainly is as essential. And yet the ascension is something we pass over, and unless you're in a liturgical church, the ascension Sunday is never mentioned, the ascension period is never mentioned, it's just completely passed by. It was absolutely essential that there was a miraculous door through which Jesus left, just like there was a miraculous door through which he came. It was absolutely essential that the earthly appearances of Jesus would end instantly, and not in some gradual wandering out, like gradual hallucinations of Sasquatch or something of that nature that keeps appearing from time to time. It had to end. There was a moment in which he went to the Father and he was no more in bodily presence on this earth. But above that, my friend, the key teaching of the Ascension above all others is that Jesus took into heaven a human body. For the first time in the history of creation, man is now on the right hand of God in the form of the Son. And as a result of the ascension, every man ought to walk with his head high and a whole new concept of what has happened through humanity. That's what the ascension is about. Where is he? He's seated on the right hand of the majesty. Well, you don't need any syncretism when you got that going for you. You don't have to keep your little talisman and rub your rabbit's tail, you know. You don't have to wear your Scorpios or check your horoscopes. See, there's no sense of blending anything else when you know who he is, what he's done, and where he is. He's in the center of the power of the universe. And he's seated on the right hand of the Father. But there's another picture. We're not through yet. Just in this opening two verses, friends. And I'm passing quickly. That word such, you know, just doing a little studying and thinking, of course, it's a perfect octave back to the very words are used. We have such a priest. And just thinking of that, that's a whole message. You could just stop right at that. And in fact, a Bible student does. You're going through and we have such a high priest. And your mind stops. Such a high priest. Yes, that's what he's talking about. This is the conclusion of everything he's been saying. What's he been saying about that priest? His character, his provision, his offering, his ministry, who he is, what he's done. There's another picture here. Not only is this the sum that we have such a high priest who sat down at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heavens, but he is what? He is a minister of the true tabernacle. This is beautiful. Because the word minister here is one of the neatest words in the Greek language. It's an interesting word, and I have taken much less time with going over any of the original words in this study and tried to just help you with principles. This is a word you need to know. It's the Greek word leitorgos, L-E-I-T-O-U-R-G-O-S or E-S, depending on how you transliterate the Greek into English. But let me tell you about that word a moment. It's the highest word in the Greek language. The leitorgos was a man, generally a wealthy man, who turned his fortune or his wealth to the good of the people. In fact, it's the actual meaning, one of the words, one of the translations of Letorgos is a servant. But meaning a man who serves. The Letorgos was the man, for example, who would give his fortune to providing the great chorus for the city so that the great dramas could be put on. The Letorgos was the man who would build the library. He was the man who would invest in the good of the people, who served. In fact, it's interesting because the word, and it's one of the most, this is a very important word here, L-E-I-T. And if you can just kind of remember, L-E-I is a combination that spells A, or it sounds like A in the English. So you have L-A-I-T. Does anybody know a word that reminds you of? Laity, okay. You see, the word late means the people. Its general combination means the masses, the people in general, humanity. And this particular form is a possessive form of the Greek, which means belonging to the people. The last part of the word, the orgos, as it comes out, is from the word ergo, or to work. So what is Jesus? He is one who works in a manner belonging to the people. He ministers on behalf of the people. You see, it's a very specific phrase. Ministry is a word that for most of us, we would see the word minister here, and it would, you know, we think of preachers and churches and all that kind of thing. No, that's not what he's saying at all. He is one who belongs to the people and whose contact is with the people and who goes forth to work on behalf of the people. And his work on behalf of the people, and this is the fourth thing out of these two verses, is in the true tabernacle. And he says it this way, that true tabernacle which the Lord pitched and not man. Now we're going to have to do a lot of studying in the next couple chapters, and I don't mean that we're going to get into detail that will bore you, but we are going to have to remind ourselves clearly of what we have studied in the past concerning the tabernacle. And let's establish something about that tabernacle. This is called, we call it the Mosaic Tabernacle. Some people call it the tabernacle in the wilderness. It's the tabernacle that God had Moses build in the wilderness. But remember this, and this is something that I'm amazed that even Bible teachers who seem to completely ignore this. For example, I hear constantly among even my colleagues that teaching the tabernacle is an irrelevant thing, an unimportant thing. But what God said specifically to Moses was, number one, he said, Moses, you must, this is in Exodus chapter 25, he said, you must make this according to the pattern which I showed you in the mount. Now, what did God show Moses in the mount? He showed him a copy of that which was in heaven. So that what we have here in the wilderness, the Mosaic Tabernacle, is a copy of a copy. But the original copy was made by some heavenly architect, probably the Spirit himself, so I'm sure it was a pretty neat piece of art, you know, the one that Moses saw in the mountain. Reproduced that as God commanded him to. And of course, as you know, the reproduction was incredible. I mean, just this tabernacle. I've talked to you about it before. 300 yards of linen, 8 feet tall, 75 feet long, in the middle of a desert. And in the middle of it was this tabernacle itself. Actually, the tabernacle really looked more like this because that particular building was covered outside by a series of skins, so it looked like a tent like this. And then inside that tent
was the structure part, which was the tabernacle itself. And it was structured of boards made of shittim wood covered with solid gold. If you can get any picture of what this was like going inside here, can you imagine? These two walls were solid gold. In the holy place, three walls were made of solid gold. And each of the utensils, the showbread and the ark of the altar of incense and the candlestick, were all made of gold. And of course, the mercy seat and the Holy of Holies. But now what he says is this, in this passage. He says, that is a copy of what was, it's a copy of the copy that I showed Moses in the mountain, but what Moses saw on the mountain was a copy of what is in the heavenlies. And that's where the true tabernacle is. Now, some people are bothered by this word true, because true to them means true as opposed to false. That isn't true. To use a pun. This means true as opposed to the genuine. Not false. For example, we have a Xerox machine in our office. We use it an incredible amount, all of us. When I put a copy on that Xerox machine and the copy comes out, it is a true copy. But it is not the original. It's not the genuine. It is a copy, even though the facts are true and right and everything about it is methodically reproduced. One is a reproduction and one is the original. So we're not saying the true tabernacle in heaven, meaning the one in the wilderness that we talk about here, was false, but that this was a reproduction in a scale that man would understand. Now, when you read the book of Ezekiel chapters, I guess chapters 39 on actually, and you read the book of Revelation, and you get this marvelous picture of that true tabernacle which is pitched in heaven. Now, I'm sure that when we talk about things like the throne of God. Now, the throne of God in this tabernacle became the mercy seat. This was the throne of God. Now, nobody believes God dwelt in that place. That's where he was all the time. That's not what he was trying to tell Moses. He was trying to demonstrate for Moses and the people a manner in which he could illustrate his presence among them and the holiness and austerity of that presence, and the necessity of the blood atonement for their sins, and the necessity that if they were to be in fellowship with him, it had to be on the basis of an order and of sacrifice and of understanding who they were as well as understanding who he was and so forth. But when Christ came, the veil was eliminated. And all of that partial photographic view was gone. No, I always think there's something kind of tragic about making love to photographs. Never could get into that. I don't know if that says something about my masculinity or not. I never could get into being very inspired by a photograph, no matter how big it was. And all the colleges I've gone to, of course, all my roommates had beautiful photographs, which will go unmentionable at this point. One of my roommates had, he must have had custom made, because I'd never seen it before, that kind of thing before. But it was the full door going into his room that was covered with this huge picture. But somehow that never communicated to me, because I'd rather hold a real girl's hand than look at Brigitte Bardot in a photograph. And yet here is the thing that is being said about Jesus' ministry. And we're going to have to look at that, because what we see in the Bible about the true in heaven is just photographically reproduced in the tabernacle, and yet that helps us understand. We talk about the throne of God, the sea of glass, all of the descriptions of the surrounding elements, the candelabra, the candlestick, the lampstand, all the things that we see in that old covenant teaching are just like kind of reproductions on our level to help us understand heavenly divine principles. But here he wants us to understand that this such a high priest as we have has sat down in the right hand of the throne of majesty, and he has become the minister of the true tabernacle. And when we come back to this next session, we will begin first of all with these three things. We will review this slight view of his priesthood, and then we get immediately into the new covenant, because that's the principle. The old tabernacle was based on the covenant. It was the covenant that told them what sacrifices to make, how to make them, when to do it. So the priesthood of Jesus has as its foundation a new covenant. But the covenant changes the whole ball game. The old covenant was blood sacrifice. Do this. If you do this, I'll do that. If you keep this, I'll do so and so. If you. There is no subjunctive ever under the new covenant. Ever. There's no if. That's why the new covenant's a success. I guarantee you, my friend, if there's an if in anything, you're gonna take the if. You're gonna be the if. If there's a question mark in anything, you'd be it. I would be it. If there's any way to miss it, we'll miss it. If there's a condition, we'll fail it. And there is no condition in the new covenant. None. In fact, wonderfully, God had prophesied that through Jeremiah, and that's what we'll look at next week. That's the primary subject we'll talk about next week, is the new covenant. But wonderfully, God, even when the people were worshiping under the old covenant, which said, if you do, I will, if you will, I will, if you will, I will, and the new covenant comes and God says, but I'm going to give you a new covenant. I'm going to write it in your heart, and I will, I will, I will, I will, I will. No ifs. In fact, when you read the new covenant, Jeremiah was given this passage, entire change. It's inward now, not outward. It's in the heart, not in the performance. It's a whole new attitude. And that new covenant is the basis of his priesthood in heaven, just like the old covenant was the basis of the Aaronic priesthood on earth. So we'll have to look at that. And then we're going to go right into the sanctuary. And this is why many people call the book of Hebrews the Holy of Holies of the New Testament. Because when we move through chapter 9 and through chapter 10, we're going to see Jesus in priesthood ministry as he is not described anywhere else in the Bible. We're going to see pictures, and it's no wonder that Paul has said to these people several times, I wish you weren't as dull as you are. Because you're going to see things in this passage that just beg description. You falter at them unless you have based on this understanding. But in order to get into this passage, it's been important for us tonight to just see why Paul says, now I'm going to sum it all up. And that's right. And the summation of that is based on, you know, what can you say? Stand with me. The summation of this is based on everything that God has taught us about Jesus up to this point. Now I'd like you to bow your heads just before we close, and I want you to take just a few seconds with me, with your heads bowed and your eyes closed. Do you understand why Jesus is seated? Do you understand there's no more offering, no more sacrifice? He's able to sit because it's finished, totally and completely. Secondly, do you understand his character? Have you gotten some photographs?